The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Tesco Grocery Home Shopping. If you can't come to us, we'll come to you. Tesco. Every little helps.
Good morning. You're very welcome. It's Brendan O'Connor in for Marion. And let's start this morning with the Sunday Business Post that they're leading with co-living developer residents not covered by tenancy legislation. So this is Bartra Capital, the firm behind a 208-bed space co-living scheme approved in Dunleary, has sent a legal memo to Dublin City Council. So what they're essentially saying is that these people will not be tenants. They will have a licensing arrangement. They will be more members of a club, and they see it as a kind of a hotel style arrangement. So in other words, they won't be covered by things like rent controls and all the other protections that tenants enjoy. And they say they have legal advice to that effect. They also have government rejects new Tory blueprint to avoid hard border. It's not so much a new Tory blueprint as this is the alternative arrangements for the Irish border report. And these alternative arrangements have been floating around for a while, but I think Boris was kind of touting them again last week and has tried to inject life back into them because I think he felt they never got a proper outing originally. Anyway, the Irish government has rejected that. The Sunday Times leads with more FAI stories, and they have more stories of carry on at the FAI inside as well. They also have that English and Scottish police ready to patrol Irish border. So under something called mutual aid, it was previously used during the London riots and the G8 summit in Fermanagh. In a high risk or an emergency situation, police can be sent to other parts of the UK under mutual aid. So they are saying that in the event of a no deal, they will be deploying police officers from England and Scotland to the border in Northern Ireland. They also have a story there that the plan to kick private care out of public hospitals will cost 6.6 billion. No, nothing is simple in this country, is it? Nothing costs less than billions anymore. So this is obviously an attempt to, in the longer term, to improve public healthcare, but by taking private healthcare out of the public hospitals, but it will take twice as long as recommended in Sláintecare care apparently, and it will cost 6.6 billion. But that does include then staffing up parts of the hospital that would previously have been possibly used for private stuff. The Sunday Independent, overrun GPs turn away new patients. So basically, this is a special investigation by the Sunday Independent where they found that roughly half of the GP practices in the country, I think they rang a third of the, there's about 1,000 GP practices in the country, about half of them are full up and will not take any more patients. And obviously that has all kinds of ramifications, and that's inside a few pages inside the paper as well. They also, Philip Ryan has a story here that Johnson toned down Brexit stance after bombs, so that the government apparently believes that a dissident Republican attack on the border last week forced Boris Johnson to tone down his language about Ireland and the controversial backstop. The source made the extraordinary suggestion that Mr. Johnson and, quotes, the Brits were being, quotes, a bit friendlier towards Ireland as a direct result of the dissident attack, which was aimed at killing PSNI officers. The Irish Mail on Sunday, Maria Bailey kept her job after sacking. So, as far as I can see here, what this story is suggesting is that on the 23rd of July, Leo Varadkar said that Maria Bailey was being stood down as chair of the Housing Committee. But Maria Bailey, nobody told the Oireachtas about this, and Maria Bailey did not resign apparently until August 16th. But it also seems to suggest that possibly Leo Varadkar, or kind of nobody else involved in this, was aware that Maria Bailey was also the chair of the Ethics Committee in the Dáil, the Members' Interest Committee, and she is also kind of the chair of chairs in the Dáil as well, so the chairs of all the committees. She was chair of the working group for that as well, but I think she stood down from all of them. You would think a woman who sat in so many chairs would know how to sit in a swing, but there you go. The Sunday World has disgraced convicted killers go on crime rampage while on day release. The Mirror has an interesting story. Owen Murphy, send homeless out of Dublin. So now he's, the Village magazine asked Owen Murphy, was he looking at this? And he says, we are looking at policies that will speak to that issue. So I don't know how firm that is or anything, but this is the notion of that people who are homeless in Dublin, that obviously there's lots more houses down the country and would they move down there? He does say in it, in fairness to Owen Murphy, he says, look, The first instinct we would have is that it's better for people who are in emergency accommodation or whatever to stay in the community they're in from the point of view of kids and school and everything else. And the Irish Sun on Sunday, McGregor in vile dig at rival's family. He taunts boxer over his children. There's more. Keep it classy, Conor McGregor. Now, our panel this morning, Lucinda Creighton is the CEO of Vulcan Consulting and former Minister for European Affairs. Nolene Blackwell is the Chief Executive of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre and a former member of the Commission on the Future of Policing. Gerard Howland is a Public Affairs Consultant and Irish Examiner columnist. Ian Keogh is a broadcaster, author and journalist. And Niamh Garvey is Head of Policy and Advocacy at Trocara and co-founder of Stop Climate Chaos. So good morning, everybody, and you're all very welcome. And Lucinda, I want to start with you. You have, I would say, quite a strongly worded piece in the Business Post this morning. The tone-deaf attitude in all capitals, where leaders simply reiterate their previously stated positions with increasing degrees of certainty and self-congratulation, provides no comfort to the people who pick up the pieces, you say. You say a crash-out Brexit is now all but inevitable. And you say, and I think this is a dig at Leo Varadkar and our own government, feeling good about our insistence on a theoretical backstop which will not see the light of day is a pretty futile government position and one which will unleash great harm on our people. And all this is by way of getting to your point that a crash out is inevitable and that what we need to do at this stage is put a time limit on the backstop, allow it to go ahead, but that it should be allowed to go ahead, but that we give the concession of a 5-year time limit on it.
Well, I mean, I support the backstop. I mean, I've articulated in that column the fact that it is essentially the only way that you can ensure frictionless movement of people, movement of goods, and trade between the north and south, and indeed east west. But the problem is that we are now stuck in a situation where we are just over 2 months from the UK potentially crashing out of the European Union with no deal. No deal means no withdrawal agreement. No withdrawal agreement means no backstop. So, you know, I suppose I'm perhaps articulating a certain degree of frustration because nothing has changed.
So you're and saying we'd be better off with a backstop that has a time limit on it than with no backstop.
Which I'm quite aware is a contradiction in terms, because the backstop, of course, the nature of the backstop is that it has to be a sort of an ongoing insurance policy which doesn't have a sunset clause and doesn't have an end date. But the problem is that we will have no backstop if Boris Johnson continues on the course of which he is currently pursuing. There is no reason to believe that it will change anytime soon.
So you're saying we blink?
We
need to blink.
Dan O'Brien has written about this a lot in the last number of months, and you know, he has described it as a kind of a game of chicken, you know, where we're basically driving at speed towards each other, waiting to see who will blink first. And frankly, with 2 months to go, I just think that's quite irresponsible, and I'm deeply concerned about it. The ESRI, in figures published earlier this year, suggests that 80,000 people will lose their jobs if there's a disorderly Brexit. A conservative estimate of the likely contraction of the Irish economy is over 3.4%. It's probably higher. So we are talking about the devastation of sectors across the Irish economy, largely impacting small and medium-sized businesses across the country.
And impacting more on
absolutely.
Rural Ireland
and
as well.
You know,
now,
I'm
ask
not.
You a question?
In fairness,
do you think if we say that we will put a 5-year time limit on the backstop, do you think that's actually going to clear it up and a deal will be done? I mean, I wonder. The backstop was one issue they had, and it's become the headline issue. But there are lots
that's
of other
very
issues.
True, but
there
I think
guys will never vote for and women who will never vote for that deal.
I think Boris Johnson as Prime Minister is somebody who wants to save face. He's not entirely stupid. I think he probably understands that this will devastate the British economy and will probably ensure that the Tories remain in opposition for a very, very, very long time. And if he can find a way to save face and avoid a hard, disorderly Brexit at the same time, then he probably would grab it with both hands.
So you think this gives everyone a way of stepping down?
It's about trying to find a way to compromise. And I know you've written about it in the Sindo today, and I know others have written about it as well. It's about finding a way to avoid the catastrophe which is looming, which is imminent, and which we cannot afford to gallop towards.
Okay. And so you're saying kick it down the road.
Kick it down the road. Okay. And likelihood is, I mean, British politics is at its most sclerotic in 100 years. I mean, you know, it is unlikely that we will have the same prime minister, the same government and the same intransigence in 5 years' time in the UK. And
so,
perhaps
so
we need to start betting on that.
We bet that things will be slightly better at that
stage. Well, they're going to be different, inevitably, and hopefully better.
Gerard Howland, what do you think?
Well, I think Lucinda is the cat among the pigeons this morning. Foreign Minister for European Affairs, confidant and friend of the Taoiseach.
Still confidant and friend of the Taoiseach, Lucinda?
Yeah, but I mean, I'm just giving my opinion.
I know,
I'm not reflecting anybody else's opinion.
I know,
opinion.
Have you discussed this with him at all?
Not recently, no.
Okay, sorry, George.
And I'm quite sure that this very interesting piece will be in Prime Minister Johnston's press clippings in Biarritz this morning, and I'd be
are you accusing her of failing to don the green jersey?
No, absolutely not. And by the way, I don't believe
that,
I wouldn't accuse Lucinda failing to don the green jersey, because I don't think there's any obligation to don. That's all nonsense. Lucinda is entitled to do again, as she has done very clearly in the past, is state her opinion, regardless of their popularity on issues, and she's a good track record on that. But the tactical issue is very important, because this will play in certain circles in a certain way. Secondly, I think the other tactical issue of timing...
Hang on, just go back a sec. When you say this will play in certain circles in certain ways, you are suggesting that this will be fed into the Tory propaganda machine.
In the UK, it will also be filed in the Fianna Fáil press office, so that in the event that there is the bad outcome of a hard Brexit and the government is in office when those consequences flow, that local Fianna Fáil candidates in local radio and border constituencies and other rural constituencies will be able to say to the other Fine Gael TD, you know, you were warned by your own about this, and this is why that mushroom factory or that duck processing business is gone to the wall.
Okay, and so to the substantive issue.
In one sense, 2 months is a tiny length of time, but it's actually eons away in terms of the politics that have to play out. The government, and we do not know how Boris Johnson is going to fare in the House of Commons, whether he is going to be done in, whether he can surmount his difficulties over the next couple of weeks on the floor of the House in terms of his numbers there, if there will be a vote of no confidence, if he will attempt, and if he attempts, will he succeed to call a general election in all those circumstances, given the slightest inkling of the slightest doubt as to the complete certainty of your stated position at this juncture, would be extremely foolish diplomatically and politically indeed.
Do you agree with that, Lucinda, that it's too early to blink, there's too much to happen yet, and that you are feeding into a Tory spin machine now, leading them to believe that we're starting to doubt ourselves in Ireland?
It's not a question of doubting ourselves. It's a question of actually trying to be pragmatic in ensuring that we don't find ourselves at the hands of a Tory government in the UK, exposed to the sort of political, economic, social fallout from a hard Brexit that no other European country is going to experience.
What do you think of Gerard Howland's very politely expressed view that it's too early to be thinking about blinking?
Well, I disagree with that, because for starters, we've had Prime Minister Johnson in place now since the end of June. Nothing has changed. We simply have a reiteration of positions. There is no change. We have the Tory conference taking place in 4 weeks' time. there will be no change before that. The only possibility, as I read it, where there will be potential movement is a general election. And if you look at today's polls, the Tories are at their highest point in 2 years. He could come back
with a stronger hand,
okay. Which would be disastrous for obvious reasons, and would make the likelihood of a hard, disorderly Brexit even more likely. So no matter what way I look at it, and I've been following this obviously very, very intently for the past 3 years and longer, I've been following it since David Cameron first mooted this, when I predicted that the UK would vote to leave the European Union, which very few other people predicted at the time. And I just don't see a point of return, frankly, from the hardline position which has been and is being pursued by Boris Johnson. You have to remember, this is a person with very little regard really for the public interest, or for the broad impact on the economy or British society. This is a game to him, and I'm simply saying
indeed to his chief advisors and the people around him, it seems to be even more of a game to some of them.
And what I would like as an Irish citizen and nothing more, I'm not aligned to any political party, as you're aware, Gerard.
I accept that, but you know how others who are unlike you are political will use.
Sure, and they'll use whatever hand they can, and I would be equally critical of the opposition parties.
But you think at the moment the government has adopted a futile position? Have they miscalculated on all this?
It's not a miscalculation. I mean, I think that the government succeeded diplomatically in ensuring that the backstop was part of the agreement, which was agreed and approved by the British cabinet. But things have changed. Theresa May is no longer prime minister. It has been rejected by Westminster. These are facts. This is reality. And when I speak to people, and I do all the time, in government, at official level and political level, you know, I'm not detecting any optimism about a Boris Johnson, if you want to use the term blink. I actually don't like those sort of game analogies. I think this is far too serious. There's far too much at stake. We are playing with fire. And I'm simply saying that if there is a way to fudge rather than face the ultimate catastrophe on the 31st of October, then my preference is to fudge. It's not ideal. I don't want it. But it's my preference. If the alternative is to have, you know, 80,000 people losing their jobs and a significant economic hit to the economy. I don't think that's a cat among the pigeons position. Yeah. That's actually, I would imagine, a responsible position.
So there's no ideal outcome to this, but you're saying we need to take the closest to a good outcome. Right.
Yeah. Ian. Look, I have to say, I'm not necessarily sure I agree with Gerard. I think for the last couple of years, the Irish position on this has been don't discuss, just stay quiet, lack of real policy debate, a lack of real discourse on matters of Brexit. So we've just had almost groupthink on it. When Lucinda's talking about fudge, I was reminded there was an editorial in Der Bild, the German newspaper, during the week, where it said what might in fact happen is a no-deal deal. So there's a load of smaller side deals that facilitate something to happen. I don't know whether that's the thinking currently in Germany at the moment. I couldn't help but look at this during the week from Boris Johnson's perspective. So he's taken over within the context of British politics. Let's forget about what's going on in Berlin, in Paris or Brussels or even Dublin, just over in London and across his own constituencies over there. Since he took over, he's up 14 points in the poll. He's been really taking on. He's won back all of the Nigel Farage, the Brexit Party, the BNP. He hasn't been winning at the expense of Labour. He's been winning at the expense of the Brexiteer Party. He's reinfolded all of that. He's galvanised his own party to the point that even The Guardian yesterday said that Downing Street was operating with more efficiency and more discipline than it was during the Theresa May government. Now, that's not exactly the high point, but considering he was expected to be so chaotic. So he goes off to Brussels last week and he's talking in France and he's talking in Germany, and they're offering some sort of olive leaf, which is you come up with an idea that gives us the backstop, but that isn't the backstop, and we'll talk. And he comes back hailing it as a triumph. Now look, at everybody who he talked to knows that that's nonsense, but it might afford him some element of compromise, and we know that Boris Johnson can in fact compromise. The worry at the moment, and the worry that I would have, and I would echo some of Lucinda's comments, is the one thing that Ireland doesn't want from this is a no-deal Brexit. That is the one thing that we don't want. It's you know, there are parts of this country and there are parts of the economy that simply will not be affected by Brexit. But there's large pockets, particularly in rural Ireland, in agriculture and pharmaceuticals and chemicals and the like, that will be absolutely decimated by it and will feel it far more radically than anywhere else.
So is the answer then that we give them something, give them a 5-year time limit on the backstop?
Well, I think it's great that we're at least having that conversation, because the idea of Ireland simply at this moment not contributing to debate or not offering up any solutions, I think that's that time, that ship is sailed. And even Michael McDougall is offering a solution also in the back page of the Sunday Business Post, which is, you know,
which
go
is
back
the IRC.
And if the DUP were off the pitch and Boris Johnson had an overall majority, might be an option as well.
There was an interesting piece in the Irish Times yesterday encouraging Irish people to think about the idea of us adopting UK standards and et cetera, kind of a reverse backstop, if you will, for the time being, right? And you look at it and you go, well, no, that's ridiculous, as we all did. That's going to cut us off from the EU. And then he said, it'll come to me, who wrote the piece. And he said, well, that's how unionists probably feel about the idea of the backstop, of them being aligned with Europe.
Yeah, but we keep on talking about this regulatory divergence. I mean, Britain has most of the same regulations at the moment because they've been in the European Union exactly the same length as us. So, you know, it's only as they carve out their own trade routes that that's going to become an issue. So we can't continually negotiate all of that on a month-by-month basis as Britain does it. That's not a runner.
Okay, yeah, Norlene Blackwell.
But I think the thing is that we have to recognise that post-Brexit there will be a border. And the thing about what I find really interesting is how panicked we've all become over the past month as we listen to nobody but Boris Johnson talking about this. It's August, there's nobody in Brussels. It's not a matter just for us. It's a matter for the European Union as well. There will be a border one way or the other. We have at least got in our back pocket a possibility of some concession or change on the backstop along the way, which was an international agreement that was signed. I think that, in a sense, it is a lovely word for Boris Johnson to have. He says, ban the backstop. Do you know, Boris bans the backstop like it's even alliteration. It's an easy one for him to do. And I'm taken back to my time when I used to be a solicitor in private practice doing a lot of family law. And you would have two people in a family law dispute trying to sort out the settlement. And then you'd have all the family on both sides coming in saying, you should be doing this, you should be doing that. And the two people coming back in saying, my mother says you should be doing this, you should be doing that.
And of course, it was never the lawyers ramping anything up, only the families.
But so in a sense, and most of the time settlements happened. And most of the time settlements happen with the European Union. So I think we can all throw in our tuppence worth. But I actually think the Irish government have done a fantastic job in acquiring things for us, like a backstop, which can be negotiated into the future. They have seriously put their mind to this throughout Europe. And instead of us being left to swing, which would have been the situation, we now have a consensus within Europe recognising the particular difficulties for Ireland. I really do agree with Lucinda when she says British-English politics are sclerotic at the moment. What will happen if we get something like a stop on the backstop? Then we will be left to bear the hiatus for 5 years while the rest of the European Union goes on its way in some way. So we will be the people who won't know what will happen for another 5 years. And as it stands, farmers who now need to put things in place for the beginning of October don't know what the rules are.
Okay, Niamh, I'm going to come to you in a second. I just want to go back to Lucinda on that. Do you take that point from Norlene that puts us in the kind of uncertainty that is killing us all at the moment for another 5 years?
But is a no-deal Brexit a better option than that? That's the calculation we have to make. And my view is that it's not. And actually, we've lived with grave uncertainty for the past 3 years, ever since the UK voted to leave. And we have seen the impact of that on the currency, for example, which has already impacted Irish industry. They have adjusted. Some have gone out of business. But by and large, they have adjusted. It's been very, very difficult. We have benefited in some respects, particularly in financial services, where we have seen well over 100 new financial services authorisations through the Central Bank of Ireland. So there have been some advantages to that uncertainty. It has definitely hit the UK much harder than it has Ireland. But believe you me, no deal Brexit will impact much more quickly and much more dramatically, and will have a massively negative impact very, very quickly on the Irish economy.
Yeah, I think we all agree that. Yeah. Niamh Garvey.
I think, you know, one read of Boris's current hardline messaging is that his audience isn't the European Union or indeed ourselves in terms of an openness to discussion or compromise, but rather with his majority of one currently having lost the by-election, that the real audience for the real hardline stance are those Brexit Party supporters who he's trying to win over. So I think maybe there's a danger of overestimating his interest in compromise in the coming weeks and months. We do, or there is, I suppose, a majority in the UK Parliament for preventing a no-deal Brexit. And I think until the 6th of September, when Parliament resumes, you know, I think there's a limited scope, really, for progress around potential compromise around the backstop.
And Boris Johnson's strategic imperative is not Brexit, one way or the other. It's his positioning and timing for a general election, which is his one shot. And everything, including Brexit, revolves around that. Brexit is tactical relative to the strategic imperative of his planning an election.
OK, well, that's your opinion on it. It's an extraordinary thing to think that one man would put himself before all of this. But I mean,
but he's thinking of he's looking for legal advice on how to delay Parliament for 5 weeks.
The front page story in The Observer, they're busy in Downing Street figuring out how to prorogue Parliament for weeks and in case, as Niamh says, that those events unfold on the floor that he cannot.
It should be said he's doing that in the interests of democracy, so that the
of course, and he's will doing, of the people he's doing everything in the interest of the greater good. That goes without saying.
There's a very interesting piece in the Sunday Times by Tim Shipman, their British political editor, really saying they're looking at a October 17 general election, and they're quoting, you know, a private briefing by Dominic Cummins, who's his main spin doctor, main advisor over there, where he said, "I'm going out to all of the huge hedge fund bosses across London, and I'm going to get a pot of cash to win this election." So they're gearing up for something.
Yeah.
On the same day as the EU summit. So it's really just plain chicken.
And the idea that Boris arrives in then with his with this in
whatever
his pocket
mandate
and arrives
it is,
in, and that then he's going to get a deal somehow. Lucinda, the texters. Lucinda making the argument that we should sell out the North for another 100 years of strife and economic loss for a bit of short-term gain.
I'm actually making the opposite point. My point is that the North, what we are talking about is a no-deal Brexit with no withdrawal agreement and no backstop on the 31st of October. What I'm actually saying is that let's try and avert that immediate outcome.
Yeah, and just
in the interest of trying to protect the North and the economy and the whole of the island.
Okay, Connor texts to say, "I am a Lucinda fan. I canvassed for Renew in the last election, but she's wrong on this one. In a no-deal Brexit, how long does she think Johnson will last without a deal? We must not bend. Too much at stake. There will be an election soon in the UK and the Tories will lose." Well, I don't know about that. There will be a deal which will protect peace in Ireland. I think we all have our own levels of kind of delusion on this as to what's going to happen. So we all have our own things that we cling to. Lucinda's right, but there must be a stipulation that when we get to the end of the time limit, there should be a vote for Northern Ireland to stay in the UK or become a united Ireland within the EU. What do you think of that, Lucinda?
Well, I mean, I'm in favour of a united Ireland. I'm not sure.
Are
it'll
you in
happen.
Favour of it now?
I'm not sure it'll happen in 5 years, but based on the principle of consent, which is a very, very tricky and sensitive issue in the context of the backstop, also, which others have commented on and written about extensively in recent weeks. But personally, but it's a personal view, I am in favour of a united Ireland, of course.
Gerard Howland, this has all brought United Ireland, obviously, hugely back into the fray. What's your thinking on it at the moment?
It has brought United Ireland into the frame in completely the wrong way. Mm. I mean, if you look at the trajectory of thinking from the late 60s, with John Hume, Jack Lynch, Gareth Fitzgerald, culminating in the Good Friday Agreement, the vision of a united Ireland that would take place slowly, incrementally, over decades in the 21st century was a coming together of people. This is old-fashioned nationalist land grab stuff. It is about a nationalist minority for now in the north, taking over effectively a reverse plantation. The ideology of it, the language of it, the intent behind it is negative. It's poisonous. It's the antithesis of anything I understand as Irish republicanism.
That's very strong.
It is very strong because it's appalling.
But it is the logical answer to a lot of the issues that are going on.
I believe in a united Ireland based on consent and not just a numbers game, the very narrow consent of a border poll done in a hurry without the preparation required that would actually underpin a really united Ireland based on willingness of majorities within both communities as distinct from just a narrow majority within Northern Ireland as a whole. And you look at that language behind that border poll idea and you look at the people behind it, and that is not a united Ireland in any sense that, as I say, those people who've led the trajectory of Republican nationalist thinking on this island positively through decades would recognise or agree with or support.
Ian Keogh. I think it's very binary to try and link Brexit with the end of partition and a united Ireland. I think it makes it, just as a business journalist, unusual to say this, but this isn't just about economics. And if there is to be a united Ireland, it's not simply about trade routes or access and egress across the island, but I think it has to be more built on cultural, social foundations. And the people in the South starting to understand some of the rationale and nuances of unionism, and them understanding the Catholicism in the South and the nationalism, that's not going to happen in 5 years on an economic imperative. And I think if a state is built around that short-term economic imperative, it's a state destined to fail.
Okay, I think that's as much Brexit as people can tolerate for one morning. Before we leave it, I want to read a text from Anne that says, thank God for pragmatic and intelligent people like Lucinda. She's absolutely right in her suggestion about the backstop. A great analysis by her. Too much male stubbornness on both sides, Gerard Howland. There you go.
Unquestionably correct.
Let's take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucan Show at rte.ie/radio.
Welcome back. Our panel this morning, Lucinda Creighton, Nolene Blackwell, Gerard Howland, Ian Keogh and Niamh Garvey. And let's talk about health for a minute. Nolene, you were looking at the GP investigation in Sunday Independent. Yeah. But before we get on to that, you did want to mention Johnny and Elaine Downey, who lost their son Jack, who were in with us yesterday, and Alan O'Keefe, who actually did the original interview with them last week in the Sunday Independent, was speaking to them again today.
All right. And it's also, Fionnuala Walsh mentions it in the Sunday Times as well. So I heard that interview yesterday, and I think if you had to give a description of tragedy, it was a tragedy how the Downeys lost their son Jack. And the headline in the Sunday Times piece is, all drugs are bad batches, say Jack's parents. So it was just about the level of love for those parents of their only child, who was now doing what he'd wanted to do since he was six. He was playing GAA and he was studying accountancy, and they had brought him up and they were so proud of him and he of them. And one bad occasion and they lost him. It was heartbreaking for them, and that's what the piece says. We are heartbroken, and then they say there's no way back for us, but there might be for someone else. Yeah. And it really was one of those interviews where you think, waste. Yeah. Thanks for doing it, because
they're their only boy. Well, no, look at them. I didn't do it. They did it.
And thanks to them.
It's an extraordinarily brave thing that they did, because I'd say very difficult still at this point. Like, the grief is very fresh for them and everything. But I do think it is making an impact on people, and it's causing conversations.
I think it's making an impact on parents. I think what John Downey said was that young people think they're invincible, and they do. And we did, those of us who remember what it was like. Yeah. But it's for their parents.
And young people are hard-wired to take risky chances. Yeah. It is part of the brain chemistry of teenagers, you know?
This was addressing parents and the need to have real discussions with their children about areas, about the absolute lethal nature of what happened just once, but it was enough.
Okay. Yeah. Now, the investigation in the Sunday Independent today, so half the GPs in the country can't take on any patients at the moment.
This is quite a big survey that was done by Wayne O'Connor, and it's an exclusive in the paper. And what they did was they contacted about a third of the GP practices around Ireland. There are about 1,000. They contacted about a third of them, and about 44% said they had no capacity to take on anybody else. 42% said they had some capacity, and another 20% or 15% said they didn't know. Yeah. So what this is looking at, though, I think why this is an important story.
What it means for people.
Yeah, this is an important story because actually this is primary healthcare. This is where people really need to be going for most of their medical needs. And what it shows is that if people can't get to their GPs, either they will not be able to access that fundamental right to health at all or in a very limited way, or they will be putting pressure on inappropriate sources like hospital A&Ds.
And it also sounds like a lot of people who don't have a GP are going to these weekend GP services.
Yeah.
Bernard O'Shea has a piece there saying no continuity of
for chronic conditions.
If
you have someone with an asthma attack, their GP knows all about it. Yeah. The weekend or the co-op won't work it. He's that piece by Brendan O'Shea. He is a working GP and it's quite a measured piece and he gives solutions. He says, so the problem seems to be worst in the rural south, the rural east, and in the commuter counties around Dublin. And he says that in Kildare, there are 44 GPs per 100,000 of population. In Ireland, it's about 68 in general, and it should be 90 or 100 in the NHS places. But he talks about things that could be done. He talks about mindless paperwork that has to be done by GPs. He talks about the fact that they can, young GPs can and will go abroad if the conditions are not just the money, but the fact that they're working the whole time beyond the hours that they should be. Who goes into that kind of a job if they can get better conditions elsewhere? And the other thing he talks about is something that's been going on for 30 years as well, is the need for better practice nurses. That practice nurses and doctors are key to a primary healthcare system, mm-hmm. and could do an awful lot of work more freely, more quickly, more cheaply, and could actually implement something. And we have this programme in place called Sláintecare that is to be implemented. And at the base of that is primary healthcare, where people can go. He says this could happen, but you have to put the systems in place. And it's kind of disappointing to see that the response from the Department of Health is, well, we're spending 200 million on something, on a GP package. That's not an answer saying we're spending this amount of money on it. The reality is the system needs to be overhauled, and these are the things that are needed.
Ironically, actually, one of the ways to get more GPs into the system is to make their work more challenging. I've done a number of events with GPs around the country. Yeah. And one of the things they always say is the nature of it, they're just simply prescribing or passing on.
Yeah.
So they come in or doing a blood pressure test and then passing people on.
So they'd like to be able to do more little procedures.
They're fully qualified to do more of that stuff, but the system in Ireland doesn't allow it. So it's putting more pressure on the hospitals when in fact most of those procedures, smaller procedures, more diagnostic tests in particular, can be done at a GP's office. It would make their role much more stimulating try and keep people around. I mean, this is a story that's been going on for some time. There are towns, I think Primetime reported on it earlier this year, there are towns all around Ireland, villages, who simply don't have a GP anymore. My own GP in Dublin retired, semi-retired earlier this year, and he does a day a week to try and, you know, alleviate some of the things. It is a massive issue. But one of the ways that GPs want to deal with it is to give more responsibility to them. They're well qualified. Yeah. And at the moment, they're simply giving out augmentum and referring people onto hospitals.
Yeah. And the other point that's made in this is that if you have a medical card, you can be allocated a GP. So, you know, you don't have to ask. You won't be one of what he calls the refused.
Yeah.
But the practice may have to take you on, but 6 months later, they can say, we can't keep them on. So this is contributing to
churn. And these people are being shunted around the place. Gerard Howland?
GPs are ageing. When they retired, are not being replaced.
And 700 coming up to retirement at the moment.
Absolutely.
But it says in the coming years, so that could be over a period.
Well, I think there is a big demographic issue in general practice, and that ties in with other issues, and I think this story in the Sunday Independent by Dr. Brendan O'Shea needs to be read in conjunction with the front page story on the Sunday Times about Donald Butler's report for Sláintecare, which basically says that taking private care out of public hospitals won't take 5 years. You introed this story at the top of the programme. It'll take 10. It will take over 6 billion. That's about 659 million per year over a decade. And this is really important for the GP story. Because, as Ian said, GPs need to be doing more. We need them to do more, and it's not just that. So to get stuff out of hospitals, we need the GPs doing more, we need better practices, but also we need much more coming from nurses in general practice as distinct from in hospitals. We have a country where pharmacies do much less for patients than they do in many other European countries. You remember in 2011 we were told we're getting a Dutch model. Well, in a Dutch pharmacy and you're a diabetes patient, they'll be checking your bloods instead of you having to go to hospital, which you do here, which is the most expensive place this can be dealt with, which brings us back to the main point. We don't have a health policy. We do not have a Department of Health. We have a Department of Hospitals, which is hardwired to keeping the hospitals open, regardless of how they are manipulated by the vested interests who profit from them.
Despite the fact that we're supposed to be going to a primary care-led model.
Year in, year out.
And funnily enough, the GPs, they're practically the only people in the health service who aren't employees of the health service as well, aren't they? Yeah. All other doctors work in some way for the HSE. GPs are out there running small businesses themselves. Yeah.
But they're effectively quasi-public servants without a lot of the benefits.
Yeah. But the point is important. They are businesses and they have to run as a business. And that's really harder and harder for them to do with the amount of admin.
Absolutely.
And just one final note on that. The good old days are over. There will be no budgets in the next 2 or 3 years with a lot of money to spend on anything.
Yeah. Well, at least we made good use of it while we had it, as always. Niamh Garvey, you're a co-founder of Stop Climate Chaos, and you've been looking at, obviously, the environment is a huge story this weekend. You were looking at the Sunday Business Post, page 2, beleaguered Bolsonaro sends military to Amazon. So this is a guy who's been blamed for creating the climate, if you will, where all this was going on. I believe his nickname is Chainsaw, or was Chainsaw. But he seems to have... Has he turned a corner here?
Well, I think it might be a bit premature to say turned a corner. I think he's certainly feeling some of the heat. There has been, I suppose, rightly, you know, international expressions of huge concern because the threat to the Amazon, the fires that are threatening the Amazon, are threats to all of us. We're in the midst of a climate crisis, and we absolutely rely on the Amazon and how it operates to help us get out of that crisis. I think we are seeing Bolsonaro sending in the military, making maybe some concessionary language in terms of the need to protect the rainforest. But I think we have to remember that he came into power on a campaign based on opening more of the Amazon open to logging and deforestation and clearing for agriculture. He's made very negative comments about the indigenous communities living in the rainforest and dependent on it. So I think it's the real direction of travel and direction of his policies that I'm not sure he's changed his commitment in terms of the deforestation and the opening up the forest, while he does seem to be making moves maybe to try and tackle this season's case of fires. But we need to see a radical shift that's about reforestation and protecting of the Amazon in the long term.
Does Trocar work with indigenous peoples in that part of the world at all?
Absolutely. So we work in Nicaragua, Honduras and Guatemala in Central America. And the indigenous communities there, again, many of whom rely on essential natural resources, are a big part of the focus of our work there, where we see land grabs, where we see the operation of mining companies and forestry, similar to the kinds of land issues that we're seeing in Brazil.
And they're essentially, they're coming in there and they're strong-arming these people off their land. Is it as basic as that,
It's pretty much as simple as that, and it goes back many, many years. I mean, there's one community in Honduras, for example, and our local partner has been working with them for over 20 years, as we've seen illegal logging really threaten their essential land rights. And it's the combination of land grab, but also the violence that communities face. So in that particular community, 100 of their local leaders have been killed over the last 20 years in this struggle to protect and maintain their rights. And this is why, I mean, we're running a major campaign at the moment looking for UN binding treaty on business and human rights that would really put human rights issues, as well as the sustainability issues that we're hearing in terms of some of the trade stuff around Mercosur, at the heart of how companies have to operate and how governments support the human rights of their people.
I did. Sky News were running all weekend. They had the good fortune mentioned to have done an investigation in the Amazon. They had a special report from there, so obviously they ran it every couple of hours over the weekend. But it did seem quite lawless, kind of Wild West out there. These logging companies seem quite sinister and everything. But then they spoke to a guy who was a farmer down there. And he had, so apparently they're genetically modifying cows. He had a cow, it was like something out of Jurassic Park, right? It was an extraordinary size kind of bullock of a buffalo thing. But he made the very simple point. He said, you guys in England were allowed to deforest everything to develop yourselves economically and develop your agriculture and everything. And why shouldn't we be allowed to do it? And you kind of thought, well, you kind of see it from his perspective. Well,
that's the public appeal of Bolsonaro. I mean, that's how he came to power, was precisely through that narrative, you know, empowering, enabling people who are living way below the poverty line to become, you know, productive and economically independent. I think what's happening in the Amazon is a matter of huge concern. If I understand it correctly, 20% of the oxygen that we breathe globally comes from the Amazon rainforest. So it's a resource that we all have a huge interest in preserving. I have a certain level of discomfort with the kind of lecturing and hectoring that took place in the past few days, particularly from some of the European leaders at the G7 and some not attending the G7.
Are you talking about Leo Varadkar again?
I'm not singling out Leo.
But Macron seem to be the names mentioned all the time around
Macron,
the Mercosur.
Macron in particular. I think we have to step back a tiny bit. Well, firstly, the sort of threats that were connected directly to the Mercosur trade deal, I think were most disingenuous, because, you know, these issues around the rainforest are well known and have been well flagged and well documented for quite some time. To turn to a developing country and say, you know, you need to get your act together. Meanwhile, we're all responsible for missing our own CO2 targets, our own carbon emission targets. Ireland is one of the worst offenders in the European Union. We are facing significant fines in the very near future.
And we all got to go through our dirty industrial revolutions and everything to get to where we are today. So are you suggesting we have to allow these people that same model of development?
No, what I'm saying is, so using Mercosur as a threat to Brazil and say, you know, we won't give you a trade deal. It frankly kind of sounds a little bit Trump-esque.
But is that not how the world works?
You use your leverage, but you also have to. I mean, if we accept that 20% of the oxygen that we breathe comes from the rainforest, then we have to support Brazil also. It's not just a question of threatening and browbeating. And, you know, you can't separate the fact that there is a movement amongst the European beef industry to resist Mercosur, and particularly some of the countries who've been most vocal in the last couple of days, the French obviously and others, threatening to shut down a trade deal with Brazil, instead of saying, well, actually, we have an interest in this, perhaps we should be contributing to saving the rainforest.
Yeah, but then on the other hand, we are saying we will support you guys with a trade deal as long as you guys play ball on climate. Niamh, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I think that's it. I mean, as Commissioner Hogan has pointed out, you know, commitments on climate and protecting biodiversity are part of the Mercosur deal. And I think given that's 2 years down the line, potentially before it comes into force, I think it is appropriate that international leaders...
Before it actually comes into force,
But I think it is appropriate, given that's still then under negotiation, to say that we take these issues so seriously, that it would be a threat to the agreement, because what's the good of having those strong commitments to climate within a trade agreement if we're not prepared then to say that we're taking it so seriously that it puts the whole thing under risk.
And to Lucinda's point about it being a bit hypocritical of us, we are, in the Taoiseach's own words, a laggard ourselves.
We absolutely are a laggard, and clearly Ireland has to do a lot more in terms of tackling its carbon emissions.
So are we anyone to be hectoring Bolsonaro?
Well, I think it's... climate change is a global threat, and all countries have to play their part. All countries have signed up to the Paris Agreement, and while Ireland's emissions are off track, they did increase by 6.5% over the past 3 years, and we do need to take huge amount of action here. It's also appropriate that at something of the scale of the Amazon, if it is every fifth breath that we take in terms of oxygen, it is appropriate that as global leaders, we also need to act globally. And Lucinda's right, to support the response to the Amazon, but as well as to give a clear political message to Bolsonaro, because his political platform is about ongoing destruction, whatever about tackling the fires.
Brendan, just one word on that as well is I think we should allow that for once this is now centre stage and we really should be looking at it. There is community after community within Brazil. So Trocra highlights it, Frontline Defenders highlight it. Community after community taken off their land so that some farmer can come in and do their modified bullock or whatever. They are not being allowed to keep their land. Their land is being taken from them. And Bolsonaro, until the day before yesterday, was blaming the non-governmental organisations for the fires because they are under threat. They are the people who are being told, go away. They're being killed and they're being displaced. So there is something about the way in which we have allowed the ranchers and the big countries to come in, not recognising that there are actually the local people of Brazil are not the people who are benefiting from this. They are the people who are being displaced, killed and persecuted.
OK, there did seem to be, on this report, it did seem to be local people as well, though, who are working on these ranches and some of them...
But this has been going on for weeks.
President Bolsonaro was elected by local people in Brazil and I don't like him. I think what he's at is bad, but that's a fact we can't get around. He's not a tin-pot dictator, he's an elected president. I think there's a particular issue right now this summer. If he gets a taste for this or he feels he's not being inhibited in some way, matters are going to get rapidly worse. If he is inhibited, I don't think things are going to get much better. But I think that's probably the best we can affect for now with this guy in office.
Yeah, okay.
But the bigger issue, whether it's palm oil, is another huge issue about deforestation. Mm-hmm. We're driving all this because we consume all that.
Exactly.
End of story.
Yeah, okay.
Look in your fridge, look in your bathroom cupboard, and then weep about it.
Speaking of hypocrisy, you were looking at David Quinn in the Sunday Times. Green hypocrites preaching a lot of hot air.
Yeah, you know, it's a contrarian view where he's just making the point. If you look, it's a bit hypocritical that people turn up in Italy to a convention on Google to talk about climate change and 116 people turn up on private jets. That... if you are to deal with something, it's not, you know, it involves leadership from the top on an institutional and industrial and industry basis and an international basis.
And leadership by symbol and example, yes.
It's not just by symbol, but by example and by action, it has an impact.
They should all have gone on carbon boats.
Just take a normal plane, for example. It's not that hard. Look at what's happened with Brazil. Industrial policy of the developed world for the last 40 years for Brazil is to try to promote beef, soy and timber farming in that region. And what we're getting now is a natural consequence of that. This isn't just a policy that's come into place with Bolsonaro. About 17% of the rainforest has been stripped out over the past 40 years. It's intensifying now. There's more effort on climate change now. But it's not a new phenomenon. I just think the first world and the first world leadership, call it that, or the developed countries in the G7 and the G20, have to raise their game, but so too do industries and corporations and multinationals, many of whom are the size of nation states themselves. We need real leadership on this issue.
And most of them are domiciled and owned by developed in developed Western countries. If you look at the rag trade, it allegedly contributes 10% to CO2 emissions globally, and that is almost all consumption in the first world. You know, we probably, most of the people listening or a lot of the people listening will have gone somewhere on holidays this summer and gone to Penny's or someplace and bought lots of clothes for, you know, €3.
Let's not single out Penny's.
It's an example. I'm not singling out Penny's.
Or even gone online and all the packaging.
Well, exactly, the packaging. Yeah.
And then sending most of it back again. And this is the millennials who are preaching to all of us.
Let's not single out millennials. T-shirts, shorts, swimming togs for €2, €1.50. You know, how do people think those products are produced?
Last word on this.
Yeah, well, I think the David Quinn article maybe seems a little bit more contrarian than it really is. If you look at the last paragraph, he talks about only drastic changes to the way we live will make a difference, and it's the rich, you know, who will all also have to live green. And absolutely, I mean, we've been saying for years there's a connection between climate change and inequality. It is, like Lucinda says, the richest people who have consumed the most and yet caused the devastating impacts that we see in developing countries.
And who, like Elton John, can then buy the indulgences afterwards.
But then I think what's critical then is then we can say maybe the richest can afford maybe to take some of the more greener options, but the role of government is to do is to enable all people to be able to make the choices that are more sustainable, whether that's investing in public transport or other means of enabling everyone to make the transition.
Okay, thanks, Niamh, and we'll take a break.
Podcast The Marian Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Welcome back. Our panel are still here. Lucinda Creighton, Nolene Blackwell, Gerard Howland, Ian Keogh and Niamh Garvey. And we're going to go back to the papers for a few minutes because, you know, there are times when we talk about nothing but our economy, and then there are times when, you know, other things come into the frame and we ignore it and it doesn't seem to matter that much. But it hasn't gone away, you know. Gerard, you were looking at the Sunday Times business section. Cormac Lucy has a piece saying, Donoghue has wasted our budgetary harvest. Now we'll reap what he has sown.
Well, whether we're going into a slowdown or, you know, a bad recession, we don't know quite yet. But certainly, I think the water is going cold in the bath on the economy already. Something is begun. It's not in the future. And Cormac Lucy's very good piece in today's Sunday Times makes the point is that we've a lot less headroom to deal with what's coming because we spent absolutely up to the max of what we had over the last 3 years, particularly since about 2015, 2016. Because of that, we have a debt that, even though declining somewhat proportionately as a proportion of our economy, is increasing in absolute terms. And our debt now stands at 52,200 euro per person.
But we all wanted that money spent. We wanted
tax cuts.
We wanted more services.
It's worse than that. What was spent wasn't enough. However, we'll soon decide it was much too much because cuts will have to come. And remember that just, for example, standstill budgets in for state agencies and programmes next year are effectively cuts. And that's what's coming. And people will rue this very shortly.
Ian?
Yeah, I mean, the idea of spending money in itself is not a bad thing. Providing it's spent on the right things and you get value for money. So I think everyone will agree that over the last number of years, we probably needed to invest way more in capital projects, particularly around education or third level. If someone said to me, what's the biggest crisis for Ireland over the next 15, 20 years? It's the lack of investment over the past 15 years in third level education, going way down the rankings. That has massive issues. So interestingly, Colin McCarthy makes a point which feeds into the same argument in his column in the Sunday Independent, where he talks about our inability to get value for money when we spend on large capital projects for state or state procurement. So he's referencing it back to the early 1970s and saying we couldn't get it then, we still can't get it now. We're talking
it's
about things like the National
Broadband
Plan.
Just explain what he's saying. It's basically about the problem with the cost-benefit analysis.
Yeah, that we've never been able to get that model right, which is, how much do we need to spend and what is the value for it? And shall we go ahead with a project on the basis of it? So if you look at how we do things, we decide we want an idea, we want something. Then we decide to do a value for money basis and an audit on it. And then we go ahead with it as opposed to the other way around.
And the value for money audit is largely done by the promoters
itself. So the departments do it. So he's calling for a public procurement act, probably under the basis, and a new agency, probably within the Department of Public Expenditure, which has the right to do that. And we've seen from Robert Watt, the Secretary General of the Department of Public Expenditure, has made a number of criticisms about public spending over the last 6 months, and they've all been blithely ignored.
I pretty much every Sunday I agree with most of what Colin McCarthy writes. I think his analysis has been spot on for about 30 years, and sadly, you know, it still tends to be largely ignored. We set up the Fiscal Advisory Council in the aftermath of the biggest economic shock that the state has faced since its foundation. And at that time, every politician in the Dáil promised to faithfully follow the recommendations and to take on board the advice of the Fiscal Advisory Council. And frankly, if I were a member of the Fiscal Advisory Council, I'd be questioning what on earth I'm doing with my time, why I'm wasting my time, because pretty much every single recommendation from IFAC has been ignored.
But the government does say we are listening and we are taking it on board.
But they're clearly not, because again and again, its recommendations are ignored, its warnings in the run-up to every budget are ignored. I thought one of the interesting things that I saw during in the last 7 days was the share prices, or the share value of the pillar banks, which I think is a really, really stark warning as to where the economy is and where we're going. And I think we should be really concerned about it. And it feeds into my deep concern about what's coming in relation to Brexit.
I think there's a bigger issue about those two banks. And it goes way beyond the Irish economy. It goes around how they're structured, how they're resourced, the level of money they put into IT. And I think the biggest issue, I imagine if I was in the Department of Finance and have an agency that looks at an area within there that looks at the state's holding in the bank, the chances of them being able to offload any more of their stakes in the Irish banks over the next, I would say, 5 years. It's completely not going to happen. We are stuck with it.
And there's a discussion going around that these banks are not fit for the future. Is that what you're alluding to, basically? Is banking going to be disrupted in the way that so many other things have been?
It's not just the Irish banks. If you look, and there's a piece, actually, Peter Kinsella has a piece on it in the Business Post where he's talking about large piece suggesting that large parts of European banks, particularly areas within them, are probably going to have to be nationalised. They're just being disrupted. There's been a perfect storm. Over the past 10 years, most of the European banks haven't been able to invest in technology because they've been cash-strapped and trying to get off dodgy loans off their balance sheets. Meanwhile, banks like Starling and all of that have propped up, offering an entirely different offer, online only, fit for purpose. And it means nowadays most people are really only dealing with their conventional banks, the high street banks, for a mortgage. It's just the level of interaction with it. Otherwise, most of millennials or that are dealing purely with online banks.
And most people with good broadband. So in a sense, again,
the model has completely changed. Yeah. And the lack of capacity of the Irish banks to invest in that area puts them at a massive disadvantage.
Yeah. And so these are like the bricks and mortar retailers, the way we're seeing them being wiped out at the moment.
And the same is true of banking. It's like every industry, it changes and the requirements from it change. And as I said, it was a perfect storm at exactly the time the technology was coming on stream, where the banks should have been investing heavily in technology. They were trying to recapitalise. They were trying to reduce all of their loans. And, other things were on their mind, which puts them at a massive competitive disadvantage. Yeah.
And that might tie back in, though, Ian, to what you were talking about before, that looking at the stakeholders for banks, in a sense, banks lost their stakeholders to a great extent. They might have kept the people who had shares in them, but they lost the popular vote, as it were. So coming back to what we can do with the economy, the way we were saying that people wanted us to spend money. But what's really kind of stark is that we wanted it spent on better health and housing, really. If you look, Sam Smith has a piece in the Mail as well, talking about how these are the perennials, where actually even the spending we did doesn't seem to have given us the value so that everyone has somewhere to live and that people have access to a decent health service. So that's kind of going to be key. Also, in that Colin McCarthy piece, I really think it's interesting. I did not know before. We had a committee on cost overruns, which published a report back in 1982. So this is such a circular conversation. You need to go back into the archive and see what discussion was had here about it at that stage.
OK, before we leave it, I want to ask briefly, because Gerald Howland, you're roughly from one gene pool, and Lucinda, you're roughly from another gene pool, so we'll have balance here. Sam Smith is basically saying that Leo's chances of being re-elected are diminishing all the time, and that is to do with things like the Children's Hospital overrun, the National Broadband Plan. Is that true, Gerard Howland?
It is. So his margin of error is tighter and tighter all the time. Time is against him. Issues continuously crop up. Mistakes are being made. Fianna Fáil, time is on their side. But it's still Leo's to lose, I think, by the tightest of margins.
Lucinda?
I agree. I mean, I suppose the strategy on the part of Micheál Martin has been to basically sit back and say and do very little, and sort of hope for the best in terms of unforced errors on the part of the government. And it's been working out pretty well for him over the last 12 months, and particularly the last 6 months, things like the Children's Hospital and a range of other issues. I think again, Brexit will be very, very key to all of this. I mean, if somehow we manage to avoid, an economic calamity in the latter part of the year, it'll certainly play well. And I think, in Absolutely. Fairness, I think that the perception of Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney in terms of how they've handled the diplomacy around Brexit
and
is very positive.
Issue, yeah.
And that is a strength for the government. But of course, it won't be a strength if we end up with no deal all of the fallout.
So they've backed everything on that one horse now. And okay.